We're not crazy, the system is. Tune in to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health, Wednesdays 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time, on Pacifica affiliate WXOJLPFM 103.3 Valley Free Radio, produced by Freedom Center and the Icarus Project, streaming live, podcasting, and archived at madnessradio.net. Thanks a lot for tuning in to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. And today on Madness Radio, we are talking about the personal experiences of John Rice, who is a DJ who lives in Phoenix City, Alabama, and he had a terrible experience in the psychiatric system and was able to get out of that and turn his life around through the power of music and becoming a DJ. And we're going to be talking about his experiences today. So we have John on the line. John, thanks a lot for joining us on the show.
I'm glad to be on the show, Will. I appreciate you asking me. Now, I'm not a radio DJ. I run a mobile sound system.
Yeah, what is it called? Blue Beat Productions now, or
no? Blue Beat Sound System.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I guess there's a lot of different things to talk about. The whole aspect of music and madness, or music and recovery, is really interesting. And maybe we can just start with you had mentioned, we were talking just a little bit moment ago, about your own upbringing in the South during the time of the Civil Rights Movement and how that kind of influenced you. Do you want us to get us started with that? And then, you know, we had talked about how often people like you and I and others who get into the system have difficulty fitting in or adjusting. And so maybe just tell us about, you know, what was it like growing up in the South during the time of the Civil Rights Movement?
Well, I was born in Montgomery. My father and mother were, my father was a Methodist minister, and he was third in his family to be in the ministry, and there was a very strong liberal tradition running through my father's family, a view of religion that is really the antithesis of what a lot of religion today seems to, you know, put forth. And my father was a very young, father and Methodist minister at a small church in Montgomery, and another minister in downtown at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church was a very young Dr. Martin Luther King. And so my father was right there when Rosa Parks, was in Montgomery when she refused to get up. And, of course, that was pretty much the spark that started a movement that my father always said wasn't limited to race. And certainly Dr. King felt that way, too. And my father was one of many white ministers in Montgomery who was faced with a choice of possibly putting his family and himself in danger, because the threats were so cruel and so lethal toward people that had anything to do with this integration idea. And so my father was torn between doing what he felt led to do and putting us at risk. And I sort of came out of that with a very strong sense of conviction, but because when I came of age, for some reason, even though I was a shy kid, I wanted to speak my mind, sort of out of pride for what my father stood for. So I was subjected to a great deal of ridicule, when I got into grammar school.
What kinds of things were you speaking out of? Just general kids stuff?
Well, I tell you, in the South then, and it would astonish you how long this issue, racism is still very prevalent everywhere, but it's not as open now. But in the 60s, I'm telling you, it was so ugly. And I just basically made the point in public school that in my mind, black children should come to our school. And I'm telling you, that's enough back then, you know.
Wow, that was a really courageous thing to
well,
say.
Well, I don't know. It's just what I've just always, sort of spoken my mind about something I really believe. And it hasn't always been the wisest thing, but certainly in, you know, And kids just echo what their parents say, and you would be astonished at some of the echoes I heard in grammar school.
Well, did you kind of feel like an outsider in school and growing up? Were you sort of like someone who didn't quite fit in?
Yeah, you know, I guess I did, but the thing is, I was always sort of smart. My grades were really good, and my teachers always, you know, said this is a real smart child here, and in the context of being an extremely rewarded student, you know, for getting A's and everything, I didn't fit in, even, you know, in the context of being a good student, you know. And by the time I got to high school, even though my grades remained real good, I think I began to be labeled as somebody that didn't apply himself, quote unquote, in the right way, you know.
Was that sort of how the process kind of started that finally ended up you getting into the mental health system? Was that sort of when the sort of conflicts or difficulties?
Yeah, you know, I think at that point, what was happening and what was difficult for me, and I can understand it in a much clearer way now. I believe what was happening is I was beginning to understand that there was a lot of things about education that I didn't especially dig, you know. I didn't really want a scripted life, to be frank with you. I was afraid of a life where everything went according to plan. Somehow, instinctively, I knew that that wouldn't work for me. And yet somehow, I always felt as if I had no choice but to do that. And what I'm referring to mainly is going off to college, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I really didn't need to do that, and I approached it almost as if it were induction into the Army or something, but I hardly let anybody know, you know, that I really felt like it was the wrong thing for me to do.
And so when you got to college, it ended up being really difficult for you?
Yes, it was extremely difficult for me. You know, it manifested itself in a phenomenal desire to go home, you know, and go to junior college or something. You know, I in no way it was I against education per se, and in no way am I now, but it appeared to me that I wasn't being educated in a way that would help me. You know, and I was living in a dorm, and I just didn't fit in. I mean, you know, the it was a small school in Montgomery, actually, but, you know, the guys in the dorm and all their, it wasn't a fraternity, but it was a lot like that, you know.
A lot of jocks and sort of.
Yeah, like, and yeah, I just yeah. really, really reached the point where I really wanted to come home in a way that my parents perceived as abnormal.
So you were feeling really isolated and lonely and ostracized from the place that you were.
Yeah.
And that must have put like an enormous amount of stress and pressure on you.
Yeah, and it was at that point that I was told, you know, well, if you're ever going to make anything out of yourself and use this brilliant mind, you need to stick it out. Stay the course, you know. And, you know, I've always been really, really stubborn. And I've also always, you know, they're just, I mean, it was a collision course. I knew I just couldn't, you know, stay in school. And I had been, my father had a very close ministerial friend who was very liberal, as he was, a little bit younger. And this minister was in Dothan, Alabama, which was not very far from where we lived and really from where I was at school. And I had gotten into counseling with this pastoral friend of my father's, and he was had done as much counseling training, quote unquote, as ministerial. He was real good, and he thought he was real good, and my father had total faith in him. In fact, he preached my father's funeral. He was that close a friend. And when things just, you know, continued to deteriorate at school, it became apparent that I wasn't going to finish the year. I mean, this just wasn't going to happen. And my father felt like if I took incompletes and finished later, I wouldn't lose the tuition for the second semester. And there again, I knew that I wasn't ever going to be able to do that, so don't ask me exactly how. Mm-hmm. And yet I went along with it, but the stipulation was the college needed some kind of reason to say this kid's taking incompletes. And the pastor in Dothan recommended a very prominent psychiatrist in Birmingham at a Methodist medical facility, or at least a facility partly funded by the Methodist Church. And so I was to be taken up there to this doctor, and, you know, they basically told my dad that I'd be there a few days for observation. And, you know, I wasn't real drawn to it, but I was also extremely naive about where I was going and what I was getting into. And I remember that day that my father took me up there into Birmingham, and it was when I got there, I really felt that it was just a real big mistake for me to even be there. And I remember one of the nurses said what remains to be one of the most peculiar things ever said to me. She said, "John, don't you understand that if you don't want to stay with us for a while, that means that you need to stay with us?" In other words, you know, that it's normal to want to be, you know, checked into a hospital against your will. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's that kind of Orwellian logic that seems to run
that logic
rampant.
And I was horrified. You know, none of my friends, I mean, when I got there and realized that it was basically what they call a psych ward, you know, I mean, that wasn't anything any red-blooded or American or anybody else would want to do, you know.
How long did you end up staying?
Well, anyway, her argument worked. You know, son, you have to stay. I'm sorry. And my father left. And they gave me, I remember it was yellow, and I drank it, and I felt a little better about being there and went to sleep. The next morning, the one thing nobody would tell me is when I would be released. This psychiatrist, understandably, I was very afraid of him when I realized how little he was going to tell me about things. And they did a lot of tests. You know, he said they wanted to make sure the problem was not physical. The other reason he had for me being there was that he needed to see how I adjusted to the medication. And that's almost a direct quote. And so I was, and he said that, you know, when we found out what was troubling me, that's almost another direct quote, and I got used to the medication, we'd think about me going home. That don't sound similar in any way to 2 or 3 days, you know. And anyway, I'm pretty sure I was on Haldol almost immediately. Although in those days you didn't, my parents, you know, felt like this doctor was above reproach, and that was the real problem. He wasn't. And anyway, but I was on Haldol and probably Stelazine right off the bat. And it was like the second or third night there. I mean, I was really horrified. I felt like I was in prison, and in a sense I was, and certainly not, you know. And it was like the third night I was there. They gave me a questionnaire to fill out. And I remember it so clearly. I was sitting up on the hospital bed, and, oh, I'd had all kinds of fears about, you know, if I act this way, they'll keep me here forever. And I knew I was beginning to not be myself, you know, and at all. And the doctor had said, well, he had given me this real vague thing about, well, sometimes, you know, when tension is released, we do peculiar things, you know. It didn't make any sense at all. It makes even less sense now. But I knew I was real nervous, even beyond the context of where I was. You know, I couldn't sit still. Well, anyway, I'm filling out this form, and I closed my eyes, I guess, for a minute maybe ponder what was going on. And I realized they were difficult to open. And at that moment, I began to tighten up all over. And my neck started turning, I think, to the left, and I couldn't turn it back. And I know a lot of people think about the movie The Exorcist. It stopped long before it broke my neck or anything, but it was horrifying to me. And my eyes were tightening. I couldn't open them, so I called the nurse. And, man, it was like they called some kind of code. All these people came in there. They turned on this unbelievably bright light, turned me over, gave me a shot in my rear end, and I didn't know anything till, like, the next afternoon. And this was, like, before midnight. And when I awoke the next afternoon, it was almost like waking up in another world. The nurse had a completely different attitude toward me. She said, John, you let me know if you get nervous like that again, because, you know, you had a real rough time last night, you know. I think, you know, you'll do better now. And I asked the doctor, you know, what the hell was that experience, and he gave me that vague thing again. And, of course, I didn't say it quite so bold. I was terrified. And he gave me the vague thing again about, you know, release of tension causes the body to, well, I was there 2.5 weeks, and when I was released, I can assure you, I was a complete shadow of the person that went in, worries, fears, and all, you know. I mean, I knew that I was in, you know, I felt like I was, you know, something had happened that I'd never recover from. I mean, I was so fearful.
Those were side effects of the medication, that tightening of them. Yeah, he didn't tell you that, but that's a very common antipsychotic side effect, is that tightening of the muscles and the rigidity that happens. And then when they released you 2 weeks later, you were on pretty heavy dose of these antipsychotic medications.
Well, I was on Haldol, a liquid form of Haldol. I was on Stelazine and Cogentin, which he did say was there to counteract some minor side effects.
And John, you had never been violent. You never threw a punch at a doctor.
Oh no! The only thing I had ever done in my whole life that was contrary to anything was I didn't want to stay in school. That was it. I didn't, you know. But I never threatened to. I never got angry or violent about it, you know.
It would have been necessarily a justification to put you on those drugs if you had, but I mean,
well,
that's,
and
that's
in no way was I in any way displaying psychotic behavior. I was fearful. I had some neurosis, and I was depressed. But, you know, that's not in any way the definition of psychosis.
So what happened after you were released then?
Well, anyway, he released me and said, you know, I remember thinking then, I guess this is how Nixon saw we were going to get out of Vietnam. It was an honorable time to turn me loose, you know.
Right, right.
I mean, it made sense to him, but I was on his planet, not mine. And there again, I wasn't quite so bold about it. I was terrified. I felt like my life was over. And I remember they took me home, and my brother, I had always been, ever since February 9th, 1964, when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan, I had been a huge fan of music, and it is something that was growing at that very time in my life. And my brother had just purchased the new Paul McCartney album, Red Rose Speedway, I think it was. It's out of print now. Had the beautiful song, My Love, that he wrote for his wife. And he played it for me that night, and I felt nothing. I couldn't feel it. And, you know, it was just horrifying to me in every way. I felt like even the things I loved, I couldn't in any way enjoy. And yet the doctor, my parents communicated this to him, he said, well, you're just lucky you got him here when you did, because he was just about to, which doesn't make any sense.
Wow, yeah, it doesn't make any sense at all.
Very deep in my heart, I knew something had been done to me there that needed to be undone, but in no way could I make a case for that at all, because every step I took, everything about me confirmed what this doctor said, and not anything that I said, you know.
So did you end up going back to the hospital, or were they kind of watching you? Or
I was to go back up to Birmingham, I think every month and a half or so, for a while. He was monitoring my progress. And my father did ask him if maybe the medicine was wrong. Oh, no, that's just in no way John is the problem, not the medicine. And the doctor said that as soon as you can get him employed, that's what he needs to do. He needs to do whatever, any job he can get, even if it's very physical, will give him the kind of confidence he needs to move ahead. This medication has taken care of the things that were in his way. Now he needs to take the initiative. Man, I tell you, all I wanted to do was go to bed. I mean, that's the only time I could be even remotely comfortable, was maybe if I could lay in the bed and say, you know, reflect on, this is my little room, and I'm real still, and nothing can hurt me at the moment. That's the only way I could have even a remote feeling of peace or confidence. You know?
And that's one another big medication side effect of the antipsychotics is people don't realize, maybe you're listening, that yeah, making you sleepy and sleeping all the time is a huge thing. I remember when I was on antipsychotics, that's about all I ever wanted to do was to sleep.
But the doctor, of course, said that's the worst thing for him.
Right.
And the doctor, through the doctor's recommendation, I think the first job I got was on a Public Works road crew chopping weeds with a sickle on the side of the road.
Wow.
And that was one of the most horrible days of my life. And I didn't go back the next day, mainly because I had been threatened, you know, by a couple of my coworkers.
Why did they threaten you?
I think I played up the threat, because I mean it was just a day in hell, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Like I had never.
Yeah, they said, you know, when the boss is here, we're going to work, but when he's gone, you're the only one that's going to work. They sensed my vulnerability, you know.
Wow, that's heavy.
Well, not to be undone, the next job I got was at the mill, sweeping the floor at a textile mill. 7 days a week, you go in at 7 o'clock in the morning, and they decide when you get off. And my parents, again, through their belief that I needed to get outside myself, I was told that that would be, quote, good for me, unquote, best thing in the world, you know.
And when did you start sort of coming out of this period? When did you start questioning or going off the medication, and how long, and what was it, what was kind of the turning point for you?
Well, here's the deal. That second job they fired me from, after a week, they said he's just too slow, which they were saying. That was a normal view of how I moved. But anyway, we kept going to Birmingham. I must have gone to 4 or 5 of those follow-up appointments. And, of course, every time my parents would feel compelled to say that he wants to sleep and this job didn't work out and that job didn't work out. And the doctor became increasingly hostile toward me. He would talk to them, you know, without me there, and then he would talk to me. And, you know, he about halfway through those follow-up visits, he said, you know what you're going to leave me with? One option, John. And he would be talking to me in a very authoritarian way. He said, you're going to leave me with one option to put you back in this hospital and give you shock treatments. And believe me, you don't want it, you know. And it was all about, you know, and it really fell into the notion of me being lazy and not applying myself that I'd already kind of gotten. And my family just completely bought into that, you know, and the doctor was confirming it. And then something very curious, a wonderful coincidence. My mother, who was very upset by all of this, but again, believed the doctor was, you know, I mean, she had no reason not to. She said, well, told my dad, she said, you know, if he's going to have shock treatments, we don't need to drive him to Birmingham to get them. You know, there's a hospital here. And, you know, I'm in Phoenix City, Alabama right now, but Columbus, Georgia is just across the river. And so there was a clinic here that had psychiatrists, and I was Dr. Stevens in Birmingham said that I could come to Columbus, that I would just transfer my records. So I go to the clinic in Columbus, and the doctor looks over my chart and says, well, you're going to probably need the shock treatments, son, I just hate to do that. And he said, well, why don't we do this? He said, why don't you stop taking the little liquid? He referred to pills by, he didn't even tell me the names. He said, keep taking the little football pill, which is Cogentin, and keep taking the little blue one, which was the Stelazine. He said, but we're going to take you off that little juice, and we're going to put you on a little yellow pill, which was Elavil, an old-school antidepressant. In other words, Haldol was history. He was going to try me on Elavil, and Stelazine, which, of course, is a neuroleptic, but it's not as lethal as Haldol. But it's very much a destructive neuroleptic. And the Cogentin is no good either. But, you know, being off of a Haldol, I mean, it was night and day. It appeared that our prayers had been answered, you know. I began to show real signs of being human again, you know.
Wow, so how long had you been on the Haldol and gone through this
torture? I was on the
Haldol
for a full year, yeah, which is long enough to you never get over it. I know now.
So if people are just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and we're talking to John Rice, who is a psychiatric survivor calling us from Phoenix City, Alabama. So that really was a dramatic change. You got off the Haldol, and then you started to realize what was kind of going on, and then started to try and start pulling yourself together?
Yeah, well, I really thought, you know, it was like being physically reborn. I mean, I And in many ways, I was still in for a long, long haul, because Stelazine is nobody's friend. But the Haldol, being off of it, I immediately began to show initiative, to have more energy, and to be able to become the person I wanted, I knew I was before. But there were a lot of drawbacks, a lot of things I was going to discover that down the road. But really, on the Haldol itself, I had managed. It was very difficult for me to enjoy music, but I had listened a little bit to the records that Carlos Santana was making beyond his initial impact at Woodstock, you know. And after about three or four albums, Carlos and the band got kind of tired of just being rock stars, and they began to explore jazz and deeper Latin roots and Coltrane. In fact, one record that I remember having that Christmas, actually some of the recordings were made with Alice Coltrane. And, you know, apparently the powerful rhythm was sort of getting, you know, into my, and I was beginning to enjoy music in a very limited way. And when I got off the Haldol in January, you know, I was able to feel it even deeper. And so I was real happy to be back, at least to that part of myself.
Did you really start pursuing music at that point?
Well, I just got back into it, strictly as a fan, you know. I mean, I certainly didn't, I was just like the biggest fan that ever was. And, that was often used as the example of what was distracting me from being a responsible person, you know.
What do you mean? You were collecting lots of records?
Yeah,
and
I was always,
in
high school, I was always told, you know, you worry too much about the Beatles and not enough about your studies. Even though my grades were real high, I was like number six in a senior class of 260, so.
John, can you try and describe what it is about music that affects you so deeply? You mentioned the rhythm, and can tell us try and tell us a little bit about that. I mean, a lot of us have that experience, but what is it like for you?
Well, here's where the narrative progresses. I attempted to go back to school, I really didn't know that I couldn't. And I was going to commute to Auburn University that fall. And almost immediately I discovered that when I studied for a test and went to take the test, I went to retrieve that information, it was nowhere to be found. I knew I had a memory problem, at least in being able to finish my education. And my father phoned my new psychiatrist about that, and he said, well, Mr. Rice, I'm afraid that he's pulling a number on you. The drugs should make him smarter and more capable memory rather than the opposite. And, of course, that's in no way true. And I really was basically flunking out of Auburn that fall. And another terrible thing happened. My father had a very sudden, massive heart attack and died. So I was a student at Auburn on academic probation, which was a very strange place for me to be. My family really didn't believe me that I couldn't remember what was happening. That I couldn't remember enough to do well in school. And so what I did at that point is me and my brother both, we were commuting to Auburn from Phoenix City. We took incompletes. And, helped with the obvious horrifying duty of, you know, trying to overcome my father's death, my mother, a young widow. And it was at that point that I realized, you know, that I had no credibility, that nobody was going to believe me about anything. So when we went back to Auburn, I just didn't even bother to go to class. And I'd always been real interested in writing, and I'd always been able to write in response to what I heard coming in as music. It always was a better education for me than anything I ever read. You know, the Springsteen, we learn more from a 3-minute record than we ever did in school. It's on a Springsteen song. And ironically, it was during that time that I discovered Bruce and a lot of new music, and I began to write. And I really couldn't read books very well with a plot because I'd forget the plot. So I began reading Henry Miller and literature that was like a roller coaster, almost a literary type of jazz, you know. You didn't have to remember the tune, you just had to groove and, you know, and the rhythm. And really, jazz became a real strong fascination of mine in Auburn when I was cutting class, because I'd go to the local hippie record store instead of going to class. And of course, I was found out about that and told that I was, you know, a deceiver. And I was. It was deceptive, but I didn't know what else to do. And the jazz really was something that was totally different from anything anybody around me liked or listened to. And so it gave me distance, which I really wanted, you know. And I began to just, you know, build a world inside myself, you know.
What were some of the albums and artists?
Well,
that were really
the
prominent?
Jazz at that time was it. I was really into a lot of things that the he was much younger then as I am now. The German producer Manfred Eicher, he had a label called ECM, and it's still a great, great independent label in Munich, and he was recording a young pianist that had just left Miles' group, Keith Jarrett. And I really started listening to Jarrett, and I listened to his quartet work, which introduced me to Paul Mataian on bass and Charlie Hayden. And it grew from there, but jazz for me then was something that I could cover myself with, and nobody got it, you know. And as the mid-70s moved on toward the 80s, suddenly there was punk rock. And really, it's very similar to jazz. And but I immediately immersed myself in a lot of the really radical sounds coming out of Great Britain.
How is it similar to jazz?
Well, because, and I'm sure Manfred Eicher, if he were sitting here, might disagree. I don't know. Maybe he wouldn't. But it's about feeling. And to me, you know, the thing that the Ramones and the Sex Pistols did for rock and roll is, you know, rock and roll is not a complicated form of music, and it can be done with very little else but feeling. And jazz is very complicated, and yet it is rather sterile unless the emotion is very immediate, too. That's sort of what improvisation does. So in my mind, you know, it wasn't a conscious thing, but I understand that there, you know, the concept of the feeling being paramount and what people think being irrelevant was certainly consistent. And I got into, of course, the Sex Pistols and the Clash and Ramones and a lot of what was happening, and I was very energized by it all. And it was in the December of 1980 when John Lennon was murdered, and the Clash released their third album, Sandinista. And I had been hearing reggae all over punk rock, but when I heard Sandinista, it wasn't just reggae, it was the extended dubs. And it hit something in me, a chord. You know, it was a rhythm that was different from anything I'd ever heard. And it just had such remarkable power. And at first I thought the Clash had kind of invented dub, but it wasn't very long before I discovered that not to be the case. that there was this very small community of engineers and musicians that were making music that was as powerful as scripture, you know, and yet completely without words. It was able to move a person spiritually just by the vibrations themselves, and there's a mystical quality to it that I still can't explain, because I'd always been able to write in response to music, but this stuff, when I started listening to Jamaican dub, it began to teach me things. I began to become more self-aware than anybody would have ever dreamed, and yet still, I was in the dark about medication. I had been on Stelazine, I guess, in 1980, 5 years, and I did get some retail jobs, and that worked out pretty good at first, but I had a tremor that I was very embarrassed about, and nobody understood it. And
like a hand shaking tremor?
Yeah, and I was very, very ashamed of it. I almost got phobic about the self-consciousness that would be created by the tremor, and it affected my confidence in work. But privately, I was becoming deeper and deeper involved in this wonderful sound that came from Kingston, Jamaica, and actually a very important person in that process is the owner of an independent record store in Decatur in Atlanta, and he's still there. He's much older, but I was in there, and I asked him to recommend two reggae albums, and this was when I was still sort of reeling from the Clash experience, and he said, you need to check out Original Rockers by Augustus Pablo, and I think you need to check out this new one from Bunny Wailer. And it was an album of a Jamaican pressing it hadn't been released anywhere else. This guy bought records directly from Jamaica. A tribute album to his late friend Bob Marley. And both of the records, you know, they completely changed my life. Pablo, with his remarkably humble and yet powerful dub, and Bunny Wailer, who sang those Marley songs with such conviction that you know, he was able to. Two songs on that record changed my life. One was a record that he had recorded with his group, the Wailers, before they got with Allen, called Soul Rebel. And what that told me is, really, it sort of connected me back with where I was born, Dr. King. You can be a rebel in your soul, see? And there's great power in that. It's very consistent with the gospel, but it's hardly seen anywhere in practice Christianity very much. I don't see it that much around here. The ability to want to, you know, follow your own path and your soul, that precious commodity that, you know, the born again say you have to give to Jesus, you know, and he saves. You know, if Jesus is involved, it's your possession and his, and it ain't really for anything but the power to be yourself, no matter how much courage it takes. And that really struck a chord with me, the Soul Rebel song. And then Redemption Song, that beautiful line, and I hope I can say it without my voice breaking, emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's,
you know,
beautiful.
It's in Redemption Song.
Yeah,
it's a very powerful song.
It's very touching.
And he also talked about don't be afraid of atomic energy. And I didn't know what to do with that song because I was really the Stelazine. I had grown a lot, but I was still very limited and really didn't realize that I was becoming more limited by continuing to be on Stelazine. And but I hung on to that song, and I still do.
John, do you consider do you consider yourself really part of the Christian tradition or the Rastafarian tradition? Or are you really more of a mystical person who doesn't identify with any specific religious institutional current? Or
I have broken some with my family, and I've been told that my father wouldn't approve of what some things I say. But, I mean, my father and me are two different people. I tell you what I do believe. I believe that the Christ that my father spoke for is, you know, that part of anybody that stands up for those that don't have anything, you know. And, you know, as soon the idea, the scripture, the stone that the builder refused will become the head cornerstone. That's a very powerful image, and it really was seen by Christ as sort of his legacy. But to me, it's been completely lost in the notion of, I mean, I don't know how any religion can, you know, be a part of a, I mean, the idea of saved and lost, you know. That's what really, really I've had to struggle with, and what, you know, Bob Marley and the Rastafari, they read the Bible every day, you know. And Marley was a great, was greatly influenced by the gospel, but he didn't think of any human being as being lost.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
He felt like that was a whitewash, and no pun intended there, of something much more powerful. And, of course, there's been a lot of thought in the last few years, some of it as a backlash to the evangelical movement, that perhaps there has been some literal whitewashing and changing of original text and things.
Yeah, it's a very political document, what's in there and what's not in there in the Bible. John, this is so, I mean, this is just so inspiring and very, very touching, a very chilling story of your slippery slope being dragged and finally, you know, coming out of the mental health system, and then just the music. And we don't have very much time, but I mean, is there something more you want to tell us about where things are at now for you? Are you still on the Stelazine, or how are you?
Well, I tell you, as you know, I was on Stelazine for 30 years, and the fire that was kindled by Jamaican music never died. But as the Stelazine, I felt my own personality shrinking in a number of different ways. And I got to where Jamaican music changed the way I heard all music. And I began to explore almost every phase of jazz and Broadway and really old and roots country. And over the period of years, as my I became extremely obsessive about music, I would go from one obsession to the other, always retaining that foundation of the way I heard things in a different way from Jamaican music. And the psychiatrist that had taken me off the Haldol, he went out of business, and the psychiatrist I was on at a public clinic just a few short years ago died, and I was under a new psychiatrist, and for the first time in my life, I felt like I could had enough courage to just say, you know, review my whole chart and tell me if I'm on the right medicine. And that's when everything changed. He said, if you weren't schizophrenic, you should have never been on any of this medicine. And he said, stop taking Stelazine, just like that. And I went through months and months of the most horrifying cold turkey withdrawal you can ever imagine. But when I came out on the other end, I was me again, and with a real bad short-term memory But all of this knowledge of the various types of music that I, particularly in the latter years, I'd become so obsessive about, suddenly I didn't have to be, you know, obsessive about any one type of music. All of it made beautiful sense to me. And certainly with reggae as the cornerstone, and that's when I, my mother helped me start a sound system. So, and I'm really a unique DJ in that I really dig Cole Porter as much as I do, you know, 50 Cent, you know, and I really keep up with everything. And my DJing is remarkably diverse because of that.
Well,
know.
John, I hope that you're able to do some traveling, and it'd be great to have you come up to Western Massachusetts at some time. How can people get in touch with you?
Well, I tell you, my my sound system is real easy to remember. It's Blue Beat, and that's it's based on a very obscure form of early reggae that they call Blue Beat in Jamaica. I'm Blue Beat sound system, and my email right now is your only shot and your best one, and it's bluebeat@ctvea.net.
Okay, I'll put it up on the website with the Emperor Madness Radio. So, John Rice, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a very inspiring story that you have. I hope to have you back on the show again, and maybe we can get you up to do some DJing up in Western Mass.
I'd love to do that. I was telling somebody the other day, I can do almost anything but predictable. I don't do predictable very well.
All right, well, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio is broadcast every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Pacifica affiliate WXOJLPFM 103.3 Valley Free Radio in Northampton, Massachusetts. For our live internet stream, podcasting, show archives, and more, visit madnessradio.net. Madness Radio is co-produced by Freedom Center and the Icarus Project. For more information, check out freedom-center.org and theicarusproject.net. For more mental health radio, listen to the News Hour from mindfreedom.org, Wednesdays, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have an idea for a story or guest on Madness Radio, or you just want to share what's in your head, contact us at radio@madnessradio.net.